This is Law and Disorder.
The mother of the first commissioned officer to refuse to go to Iraq is here today with us on Law and Disorder to discuss her son's case.
Congress diddles while our soldiers and Iraqis continue to get killed. There's a note of optimism. Soldiers are refusing to fight.
In the wake of the Sean Bell shooting in New York City by police officers, outrage has spread all around the world about police brutality in the United States. Roger Wareham is here to join us.
Sadly, murders of people of color by police departments around the country are not the exception. They are apparently the rule, as the murder of Sean Bell demonstrates.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
In the past week, we've had an unfortunate update to the Salim Hamdan case that we've been following here on Law and Disorder with all of you. Salim Hamdan, you'll remember, is a Yemeni national taken into custody by the United States, originally in Afghanistan in November of 2001. He's been in custody for the past 5 years. Like the more than 400 other detainees still held in Guantanamo, the lawfulness of his indefinite detention has never been judicially reviewed. He's been subject to torture in U.S. custody, prolonged isolation at the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay. He was charged in July 2004 by trial by military commission under the military order signed by Bush. A challenge brought on behalf of Salim Hamdan led to the decision in June of this year by the Supreme Court that basically threw out the military commission system as unlawful. The administration and Congress responded by passing the horrible Military Commissions Act. It basically strips detainees of all habeas rights.
As Dahlia is saying, it strips you of the right. And what's interesting about what happened here is it's Hamdan's case, but it's also, as we've said, the 450 people remaining in Guantanamo and other people who were picked up, non-citizens particularly, by the United States will not have a right to get habeas. And what happened here is the Center for Constitutional Rights brought a case in 2004 that we won, restoring the right to habeas. Congress then overrode it. 2006, in the Hamdan case, Congress overrode it again after the Supreme Court said you have the right. And so this is the second time Congress has overridden it. Now Congress tried to do it so-called better to make sure, according to Congress, or at least according to the court, that it applied to cases that had already been pending. So what happens now? A district court judge who is sitting in the Hamdan case says that this time Congress got it right. They successfully stripped habeas corpus away from Hamdan and by implication of all of the other Guantanamo detainees. Now, one thing you want to explain here is, well, if it's in the Constitution, how could they really take it away from Hamdan? Doesn't he really have a constitutional right? And what the judge says is there is a constitutional right to habeas, but not for people held outside the United States who are non-citizens. So people who are held, quote, in Guantanamo, which for the judge's purpose was outside the United States, don't have a constitutional right to habeas. All they had was a right given to them by a statute. Congress took that statutory right away, and therefore no habeas. Now, this is clearly a really bad blow. On the other hand, it is only a district court judge. We're in the Court of Appeals, with all of the other Guantanamo habeas cases, and they'll eventually go to the Supreme Court. But the unfortunate part is this is a relatively liberal judge, and he went with what the Congress did in this case. I think in the end, that the fact that people are in Guantanamo, which the Supreme Court in one of the earlier cases said is really akin to the United States, will ultimately go in favor of the Guantanamo detainees and will get the right of habeas back. But it's all up in the air. These people have been in cages now for 5 years. On this January 11th is the fifth anniversary. And, you know, we'll be sitting on Law and Disorder, I'm sad to say, possibly for another couple years talking about this.
This also hinges on the president's determination that someone is an enemy combatant. First of all, the prospect of stripping habeas from anyone is incredibly scary, but the idea that you can also do it to somebody simply on one person's determination without any type of legal procedure or rulings or guidelines is horrible. And the actual language I think people really need to hear, this is the language in the Military Commissions Act that basically amends the habeas statute. And it says, no court, justice, or judge shall have jurisdiction to hear or consider an application for a writ of habeas corpus filed by or on behalf of an alien detained by the U.S. who's been determined by the U.S. to have been properly detained as an enemy combatant.
It is remarkable because I think that is a good point. What underlies this decision is if the president says the non-citizen is an enemy combatant, period, then the right to habeas is stripped.
And not only do you not have the right to challenge your detention, say, hey, why are you holding me here? You don't have the right to challenge the conditions of your detention. You don't have the right to go into a U.S. court and say, I'm being tortured. I need relief from this.
Right. They've taken away that right as well. So we're really in a rough period. And while the Democrats now control the two houses, we'll see if they really do anything about this. I mean, I think a lot of them want to put back the right of habeas. You got the president there with a veto. But my suggestion is, why don't they just cut off the money for places like Guantanamo and secret sites? Then they don't need the president to do that.
I mean, but it's the same thing with the war. You cut off the money.
Right, they could cut off the money with the war. They don't need the president. But in fact, of course, with the war, normally the Iraq appropriation has been part of a special appropriation for the Iraq war. As a special budgetary appropriation. Now the Democrats, instead of saying, let's just cut off the money or cut it off over a period of 6 months, whatever it's going to take to get out of there, let's just not have it as a special appropriation. Let's just put it in with the regular budget.
Yeah, their whole
what does that tell us?
Their whole rationale is we're going to fund the war too, but our funding is going to be more transparent.
Yeah. Right. So what do we got here? We got Hamdan coming down. Congress twice has taken away habeas. The court upholds it now. It's not a good time.
Yeah, and all these people were held and picked up long before the Military Commissions Act was law. We have one enemy combatant still held in the United States, El Mari, and we have hundreds of people held in Guantanamo Bay and elsewhere in the world. There's retroactivity. You can go back. You can apply the law to people who were detained when this law didn't even exist.
So hopefully we'll have more optimistic news in a few months. Well, we'll see.
The mother of the first commissioned officer to refuse to go to Iraq is here today with us on Law and Disorder to discuss her son's case. Carolyn Ho, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much.
We're really pleased to have you with us. Can you tell us about your son's case?
Yes. My son, when he made his decision, called me January 1, 2006, and I was stunned at the time. I had no idea that he was going to actually take it as far as he was claiming that he was going to do. And at the time, I immediately said, why would you need to do this? Can you not just follow through on your obligation and then put it behind you and go on with your life? And we argued quite a bit, and I was so upset with him, I just hung up.
You were upset with your son because he didn't want to go to war.
Well, you know, all I could think of was I just did not want him to be vilified in the press. All I could see was this was my son trying to face the military-industrial complex. It was just totally overwhelming, and I just was not prepared for it. And it was days that I had to think through this because I was just overwhelmed. It was just a feelings of grief, of fear, of anger that he was doing this to himself. And I finally had to step back, realizing that our children don't necessarily do what we want them to do, and that We don't own them, however, and that we have to release them to do what their purpose in life is. And so I called him back and we talked, and, you know, I said, I'm so sorry that I was so rejecting and angry. And he said, Mom, I know where all of this is coming from, and I know that you're being protective and that you really love me. But he said, you know, I felt really betrayed by your trying to dissuade me from following my conscience, because he said, in the final analysis, I have to live with myself. And he said, it's not a matter of just being afraid to die, because, yes, I know people will call me a coward. But he said, it's really for me, at the end of the day, being able to live with myself. And he said, I've done the research. I've read the literature. I've seen the statistics, and I've seen the coffins coming home. He said, when there are no WMDs and there are no ties to Al-Qaeda, how do I convince myself and my soldiers that they need to fight? And he said, war crimes have been committed, the Constitution has been violated, and I, as an officer, have to uphold the law, and I cannot participate in this. And he said, I would rather go to prison and be able to live with myself than look back later and be successful in society, make a good income, and yet have to live with the thought that I have committed war crimes and I have forced others to do so.
Carolyn Ho, your son, Lieutenant Aaron Watada, is the first commissioned officer to refuse to go to Iraq. You've been touring around the country trying to get support for him. How's it going?
Oh, it's going wonderfully. I've met with students at colleges. I've met with peace groups. I've met with religious groups. And it's exciting to see the momentum building and people, after hearing his Vets for Peace speech, become so inspired by his stand and asking to help and asking how to take action. I believe truly that there is a momentum that is continuing to build, and that that people will be on board to stand up on his behalf. And I have gone to Congress, and I intend to go on Monday also to speak to individuals. We're still trying to build the appointment schedule and so on. And I'm just very, very hopeful. I'm not willing to stand back and say we're beaten down. And I remember at one point when I said to my son, do you realize this is like David and Goliath? And he said, Mom, but you remember what happened to Goliath. I just truly feel that with the growing movement of refuseniks globally and nationally, and the redress movement that Jonathan Hutto has been growing on the internet, I truly feel that this government is going to have to face what is reality. They cannot be living in denial and continue to say that we need to stay the course.
You've been to Congress. What's your reception been in Congress?
It hasn't been overwhelmingly supportive. I think you have one type of response where individuals are saying that Congress cannot interfere, that there is separation of powers. You know, this is inappropriate. The military courts have to be left to do the job that they were intended to do, and that I should be confident that justice will be meted out. I have had others who are saying, well, they'll look into the matter and try to do what they can. At this point, I don't have any kind of a clear direction from them. I'm still in the exploratory stage, but I haven't given up, because I truly feel that our elected representatives are responsible, and that if the executive branch is not following through on upholding the law, then the legislative branch needs to provide oversight, and they need to hold the executive branch responsible and accountable. And I feel that my son's case is not separate and apart from what the legislative branch is doing. I think that they would like to say that any kind of investigation into the illegality and immorality of the war has nothing to do with my son's refusal to deploy. They are saying that, and I guess it's consistent with the way the military wishes to pursue the case, that it's a matter of whether or not he refused an order, and that he cannot give reasons regarding illegality and immorality. It has nothing to do with it. They would really wish, like the military, to say, let the military deal with this as a situation where they ask the question, did he know that he had the order to deploy? Did he know that it was his duty to deploy? And also, did he board the plane or not?
That's not where a lot of people are coming from on this, Carolyn. I wanted to remind our listeners to grab a pencil. We're going to ask you how people can help your son, Lieutenant Aaron Watata. Carolyn Ho is the lieutenant's mother. She's doing a countrywide tour building support. Carolyn, what can our listeners do to help?
Yes, we have a website for Lieutenant Watata. It's www.thankyoult.org. We have a menu, and people can click on the petition page, and they can sign on electronically. This will be helpful in that we're building an e-list, a database, so that we can send call to actions to the listserv. We will also want in some future time, if he is trying to appeal to clear his name in the future, we will present that to the Congress or to the new administration. We also ask that people download the petition page and take it to their organizations, to their church groups, to schools, administrations that they work for, and have people sign on and send back the written petitions to the address below. We also ask that people sign on to an electronic resolution calling for the military to accept his resignation and dismiss the charges. Also asking people to write letters to the Secretary of the Army, to their congressional representatives, stating the same, dismiss the charges, accept his resignation. He is innocent based on Article 6, Clause 2 of the Constitution, which upholds the notion that all international treaties that we have entered into are the supreme law of the land. We have violated international law, which includes the Nuremberg Principles, the Hague Convention, the Geneva Convention, and the UN Charter. And my son has said that he is bound and beholden to uphold the Constitution above military law, civilian law.
Eric Seitz is your son's lawyer, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, Eric called me and asked me if I would go out to Seattle and testify with regard to war crimes that were going on in Iraq, particularly around torture. And we haven't followed up. I said, of course, I'd be glad to do it. What Eric had asked me was whether I would put myself on a witness list and see if we could get the authority of different people to testify about the war crime situation in Iraq. Let me ask you, where is your son now?
My son is in Hawaii. He is meeting with different groups there to build support and to try to get the congressional delegation from Hawaii to take the leadership in his support.
Carolyn Ho, give us that website one more time.
Yes. It's www.thankyoult.org.
We'll link to that on our website, lawanddisorder.org.
Of course, we will need your donations. Your generosity has helped us move this whole the public opinion campaign along. We can only say thank you very much and hope that more people will jump on board. The legal defense is costly, and also the public opinion campaign, which continues.
Absolutely. Carolyn, what significance does your son's actions have in the larger anti-war movement?
I think that he holds the banner for the entire movement, as do all the other refuseniks. I think that people sometimes say that he is a part of it and not the other way around, but I think it needs to be perceived in the broader context, and that with his victory, I believe truly that it'll be a victory for the people and for the movement, because the movement progresses with each case, and each victory is something that brings us further along the line. I think that he does not operate in a vacuum, that he has been inspired by others that went before him, and he will be an inspiration for others to follow.
Carolyn Ho, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. We're all going to be marching January 27th in Washington for immediate withdrawal of American troops from Iraq. And if there's a Lieutenant Aaron Watata Brigade there, we'll be in it.
Thank you, Carolyn Ho.
Thank you very much, Carolyn.
Mother of Lieutenant Aaron Watata, the first officer to publicly refuse to deploy to Iraq.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, good luck to Carolyn.
Thank you.
And now on Law and Disorder, we bring you a speech from Lieutenant Aaron Watada, the first commissioned officer to publicly refuse to deploy to Iraq.
I guess you could say I'm a little overwhelmed by all the support I've been given, especially here tonight. Thank you, everyone, very much. And thank you all for your tremendous support. How honored and delighted I am to be in the same room with you tonight. I am deeply humbled by the company of the other wonderful speakers that came before me. You are all true American patriots. Although long since out of uniform, you continue to fight for the very same principles you once swore to uphold and defend. No one knows the devastation and suffering of war more than the veterans, which is why we should always be the first to prevent it. I wasn't entirely sure what to say tonight. I thought, as a leader in general, I should speak to motivate. Now, I know that this isn't the military, and surely there are many out there who outrank me, and at one point or another, and yes, I am just an LT. Yet, I feel as though we are all citizens of this great country, and what I have to say is not a matter of authority, but from one citizen to another. We have all seen this war tear apart our country over the past 3 years. It seems as though nothing we've done, from vigils to protests to letters to Congress, have had any effect in persuading the powers that be. Tonight, I would like to speak to you about an idea for a change of strategy. I'm here tonight because I took a leap of faith. My action is not the first, and it certainly will not be the last. Yet, on behalf of those who follow, I require your help, your sacrifice, and that of countless other Americans. I may fail. We all may fail. But nothing we have tried has worked so far. It is time for change, and the change starts with all of us. I stand before you today not as an expert, not as one who pretends to have all the answers. I am simply an American and a servant of the American people. My humble opinions today are just that. I realize that you may not agree with everything I have to say. However, I did not choose to be a leader to be popular. I did it to serve and make better the soldiers of this country. And I swore to carry out this charge honorably under the rule of law. Today I speak with you about a radical idea. It is one born from the very concept of the American soldier, or the service member. It became instrumental in ending the Vietnam War, but it has long been since forgotten. The idea is this, that to stop an illegal and unjust war, the soldiers and service members can choose to stop fighting it. Now, it is not an easy task for the soldier, for he or she must be aware that they are being used for ill gain. They must hold themselves responsible for individual action. They must remember duty to the Constitution and the people supersedes the ideologies of their leadership. The soldier must be willing to face ostracism by their peers, worry over the survival of their families, and of course, loss of personal freedom. They must know that resisting an authoritarian government at home is equally important to fighting a foreign aggressor on the battlefield. Finally, those wearing the uniform must know beyond any shadow of a doubt that by refusing immoral and illegal orders, they will be supported by the people not with mere words, but by action. The American soldier must rise above the socialization that tells them authority should always be obeyed without question. Ranks should be respected, but never blindly followed. Amen. Awareness of the history of atrocities and destruction committed in the name of America, either through direct military intervention or by proxy war, is crucial. They must realize that this is a war not out of self-defense, but by choice, for profit and imperialistic domination. Yeah. WMD, ties to Al-Qaeda, and ties to 9/11 never existed, and they never will. The soldier must know that our narrowly and questionably elected officials intentionally manipulated the evidence presented to Congress, the public, and the world to make the case for war. They must know that neither Congress nor this administration has the authority to violate the prohibition against preemptive war, an American law that still stands today. This same administration uses us for rampant violations of time-tested laws banning torture and degradation of prisoners of war. Though the American soldier wants to do right, the illegitimacy of the occupation itself, the policies of this administration, and the rules of engagement of desperate field commanders will ultimately force them to be party to war crimes. They must know some of these facts, if not all, in order to act. Mark Twain once remarked, "Each man must for himself alone decide what is right and what is wrong, which course is patriotic and which isn't. You cannot shirk this and be a man. To decide against your conviction is to be an unqualified and inexcusable traitor, both to yourself and to your country." By this, each and every American soldier, Marine, Airman, and sailor is responsible for their choices and their actions. The freedom to choose is only one that we can deny ourselves. The oath we take swears allegiance not to one man, but to a document of principles and laws designed to protect the American people. Enlisting in the military does not relinquish one's right to seek the truth, neither does it excuse one from rational thought, nor the ability to distinguish between right and wrong. "I was only following orders" is never an excuse. The Nuremberg trial showed America and the world that citizenry, as well as soldiers, have the unrelinquishable obligation to refuse complicity in the war crimes perpetrated by their government. Widespread torture and inhumane treatment of detainees is a war crime. A war of aggression born through an unofficial policy of prevention is a crime against the peace. An occupation violating the very essence of international humanitarian law and sovereignty is a crime against humanity. These crimes are funded by our tax dollars. Should citizens choose to remain silent through self-imposed ignorance or choice, it makes them equally as culpable as the soldiers in these crimes. The Constitution is no mere document. Neither is it old, outdated, or irrelevant. It is the embodiment of all that Americans hold dear: truth, justice, and equality for all. It is the formula for a government of the people and by the people. It is a government that is transparent and accountable to whom they serve, and it dictates a system of checks and balances and separation of powers to prevent the evil that is tyranny. As strong as the Constitution is, it is not foolproof. It does not fully take into account the frailty of human nature. Profit, greed, and hunger for power can corrupt individuals as much as they can corrupt institutions. The founders of the Constitution could not have imagined how money would infect our political system. Neither could they believe a standing army would be used for profit and manifest destiny. Like any common dictatorship, soldiers would be ordered to commit acts of such heinous nature as to be deemed most ungentlemanly and unbecoming that of a free country. The American soldier is not a mercenary. He or she does not simply fight wars for payment. Indeed, the state of the American soldier is worse than that of a mercenary. For a soldier for hire can walk away if they are disgusted by their employer's actions. Instead, especially when it comes to war, American soldiers become indentured servants, whether they volunteer out of patriotism or are drafted through economic desperation. Doesn't matter what the soldier believes is morally right. If this is a war of necessity, why force men and women to fight? When it comes to a war of ideology, the lines between right and wrong are blurred. How tragic it is when the term catch-22 defines the modern American military. Aside from the reality of indentured servitude, the American soldier, in theory, is much nobler. soldier or officer, when we swear our oath, it is first and foremost to the Constitution and its protectorate, the people. If soldiers realize this war is contrary to what the Constitution extols, if they stood up and threw their weapons down, no president could ever again initiate a war of choice.
That was Lieutenant Aaron Watada, the first officer to publicly refuse to serve in Iraq. Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
Our next guest is human rights attorney here in New York, Roger Wareham. Roger Wareham is a graduate of Harvard and Columbia Law School. He's been practicing human rights law and has been an outspoken political activist here in New York City for 30 years. He's the International Secretary General of the International Association Against Torture. It's a non-governmental group at the United Nations, and he's one of the central organizers in the protest against not only the murder of Sean Bell, but the whole police culture that allows for those kinds of murders to systematically take place. Attorney Roger Wareham, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here. I've listened for forever, and I'm honored to be invited.
Well, we got a mutual admiration society. We admire your legal work, and we're particularly glad to have you down here to talk about the Sean Bell disaster. Not just precisely what happened, but also what your thinking is in terms about what we can do about it.
Well, I think you call it a disaster. It's a massacre. Excuse me, what happened to Sean Bell? But it was very interesting. Before Sean Bell was executed, we had already put in we being the organization I belong to, the December 12th movement, had already put in an application for a sound permit to hold a demonstration at One Police Plaza because of just the increasing incidences of just abuse, particularly in the Black and Latino community committed by the police department. And so some of it involved our own folks, some of it involved just reports we were getting from around the city of just false arrests, beatings, people being cursed, total lack of respect that the police department had for the Black and Latino community, which reached its logical but extreme conclusion in the execution of Sean Bell, which was not an anomaly and certainly wasn't new. The way that they like to characterize it as, well, it's just a bad cop. It's a few bad apples. Oh, it's a rogue precinct. And we were saying, no, that's not it. And it's not a question of whether it's white cops or black cops. It's a question of, is a culture in the New York City Police Department, which is grounded in racism, which says that in black and Latino communities, you basically have a license to kill. You can do anything you want. You're going to be treated with impunity. You're going to get immunity. Nothing's going to happen to you. You're not going to be held accountable either by the police department or the judicial system. And so our initial idea when we had planned the rally was to try and to have our quote-unquote elected officials, most of whom are missing in action, demand a sit-down with the mayor and police commissioner on this policy question and to force them to acknowledge the policy that it was racist and to move to change it. And it was very interesting because I think it was like the middle or early, the second week in November we were planning. I mean, actually, it was earlier than that, the first week in November. And we were saying, you know, that's a long time for us to be calling for a rally like a month away or 3 weeks away. And I said, well, you know what? They're probably going to do something that's going to help us organize for it. And I had no idea it was going to be what happened with Sean Bell. But it's they're not aberrations. These are not isolated incidents. This is just part of a pattern and practice that the police department has in our community. So,
Roger Wareham, a New York City civil rights attorney, and we're talking about the Sean Bell massacre, the background to it. I know I've been living in New York 31 years, and it's just been a regular aspect of my life since I moved here. What can we do about it? If you had your druthers, what would you force the city to do?
Well, you know what? We're trying to deal with it in two levels. One, just the more immediate demand is for the firing of Police Commissioner Kelly. Not that that's going to resolve anything, but it certainly has a symbolic value. The execution of Sean Bell was not an aberration. You had Diallo in 2001. You had Louis Kishon Watson, which was a case we worked on back in 1997, a young man who was shot unarmed, sitting in his car, shot 23 times by the street crimes unit, the same unit that killed Diallo. What happened with Sean Bell happened on Kelly's watch. And at some point, someone's got to take accountability for the culture that exists in the police department.
When you say culture, what do you mean precisely?
Culture that forms the mindset of the police department is that whether you're a white cop, a black cop, Asian, Latino, whatever, there's a mindset they have around who are perps, who are skells, what communities you can commit certain crimes against, and who you can take certain actions against without retribution. They understand that the things they do in the black community, they cannot do in the Jewish community. They cannot do in Williamsburg what they do in Bed-Stuy. They cannot do in Bensonhurst what they do in Bed-Stuy. They don't do what they do there, they won't do in the community where John Gotti's family lives.
It's really a culture of impunity almost.
Right.
I mean, it's not just they can do the acts, they can do that, of course.
Right.
But it's also impunity,
right.
Really.
It's
can get away with whatever
exactly
they want to do.
Right. It's a culture of, in my view, they are the largest, best organized gang in the United States. They have their colors. They have weapons that they basically carry death on their hips. They have a free ride of impunity. And they know that, and that's the culture of the police department, so that black officers would not shoot a white kid in Bensonhurst. White officers wouldn't do it. You may find in the history, the recent history, maybe one or two instances where a white person was killed, I think Gideon Bush.
Right, that's the one.
But
I
that's
was
the
thinking.
That's the exception. Right. The norm is that the victims are almost always black and Latino. So Kelly has got to go. That's the first step. If Kelly goes, then you begin to, there's a signal being sent. The other thing that has to happen is that they have to be prosecuted. They have to be prosecuted by the criminal justice system. The district attorneys have to indict them.
Yeah, what's the status now of that, of Sean Bell first and then the culture?
Yeah, right. With Sean Bell, my understanding is they still are investigating, which they don't have to do that much of an investigation to bring an indictment.
Yeah, but they're like a sacred cow, the police union.
Right.
Unlike any other normal human being,
well,
they
right.
get to stall it and spin it, kind of let it settle down. They never
right.
they never
and,
really
and,
go
and
after
the district
them like
attorneys
they should.
Don't push it, so they may go through a sham of an investigation. The cop who killed Eleanor Bumpers, they had to go through two grand juries because the first one didn't return an indictment, and there was so much protest that they went through another one. Then they had a sham trial in front of a judge without a jury, a judge who was retiring, and he acquitted the cop, and then he got a promotion to a detective. So the signals they get from the department is that there's no discipline from the criminal justice system. There's no vigorous prosecution. Without those things, there's not going to be any real change, short of real uprisings and rebellions in the community, as what happened following the acquittal of the cops in
yeah.
Rodney King.
Well, speaking of Rodney King, I mean, how much of this is a national problem?
Right.
We have, in the weeks following the Sean Bell murder, mm-hmm. we have a 92-year-old grandmother in Atlanta burst in upon in her apartment and shot by cops who then actively tried to cover it up and say that, you know, get an informant to say she fired upon them. We have a student, an 18-year-old kid, holding a video game joystick, mm-hmm. Answering his front door to see who's breaking down the door, and shot to death, him and his dog. How much of this is a national problem?
It is a national problem. And when we had the rally on December 6th, which we'd originally scheduled for Police Plaza, decided we wanted to move it to Foley Square, given the numbers of people we expected. When I spoke there, I spoke about that it is a national problem. I had heard from Cynthia McKinney, and they down in DeKalb County, I think there were like 12 people who've been killed by the police. the grandmother in Atlanta. They were holding rallies. Actually, when we had the rally on the 6th, there were rallies in DeKalb. There was one in San Antonio because there were killings there. There was one in Las Vegas because there have been killings there. It's an epidemic, and it's a culture. As I said, the culture isn't restricted to New York because the culture is the culture of racism, which is the culture of the larger society, and which has been that since the foundation of the United States. It was founded on an economic enterprise of slavery. And the ideological justification for slavery for people who call themselves Christians was that you were dealing with subhuman people. And so racism developed as an ideology. It infects everything. And the problem is that in the police, it affecting a citizen, an individual citizen, and the police, the difference is the police have death on their hips. They can carry out much more damage than can an individual citizen. You can't isolate it to New York, but we're right here in New York, so we're focusing on it. But it is a national phenomenon.
Yeah, and people are increasingly looking to international tools to try to address this national problem of racism and police out of control.
Right.
You've worked with the UN Special Rapporteur on racism, racial discrimination, xenophobia, and related intolerance. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, back in 1989, we first went to the UN, really around the question of political prisons inside the United States. It was a program that had been put together by Filiberto Ojeda, who was assassinated last year. We had met with him, and we thought that would be a real good program. So we started going to the UN, and in that process, we were instrumental in actually having the appointment of a special rapporteur on racism, because they didn't have that. The special rapporteur is it's an investigator, basically. It's a French term for a reporter or an investigator. There had not been one, and we lobbied for there to be one.
And what does that person do?
And what he does, he investigates particular incidences or particular countries. And the first place he came to was the United States in 1994, and he made a report on what progress there may have been made in racism, which he found there was very little, and what the problems were. And one of them was the question of police abuse. And so he wrote a report that addressed that. We also invited the special rapporteur on extrajudicial summary and arbitrary execution, who focuses on the question of police abuse, death penalty. He came in 1997. We provided a forum for him, and he made a report. What they do is they make reports. The countries are supposed to respond to them. And so the U.S. will have to respond at some point. There's another procedure, which is called a confidential procedure, where if you show a pattern and practice of systemic abuses and it's documented and it gets out of committee, it actually then gets to the Human Rights Council and then possibly to the General Assembly. So we're working on those as well. We've spoken with the current Special Rapporteur on Racism. And so we're trying to push all of the buttons, because Malcolm X was very, very clear and prescient when he said, we cannot restrict ourselves to an arena that's controlled by the United States, which is the civil rights arena. They changed the rules. They play with them, as we can see what they've done around Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib and the prosecution of the detainees. They change the rules when they want to.
Yeah, and he said you cannot be a human unless you have first your human rights.
Exactly, exactly. And the United States, although it has ratified the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and was taken to task by it a few months ago, basically disregards it. But on the other hand, the United States is not immune from the influence of international public opinion.
That's right.
And so it's very important that we push all of those buttons and bring the international outrage, not just the national outrage, which brings me to one last point,
or
maybe not one last point, but on Thursday, on December 21st, we are having a day of outrage demonstration whose objective is to shut down Wall Street, because we understand very clearly that the police department and the mayor take their direction from the financiers in this country, and they're concentrated on Wall Street. And the Day of Outrage was a concept that we first brought about in 1987, about a week after the December 12th movement was founded. And the concept was, as long as racism continues unabated and no steps are taken by the powers that be to address it, there will be no business as usual in New York City. And so at that time, we shut down, starting from Brooklyn, the trains, the buses, the bridges, and irradiated throughout the boroughs to make a statement. And actually, it was on the same day that the Intifada began in Palestine, that to make that statement that we weren't going to stand for this. And 19 years later, we're facing the same problems that gave rise to the founding of our organization, and we're saying that this has got to stop. And so a statement has got to be made. And it's very interesting. Somebody told me on the previous Sunday, they heard Koch, talking about one of the Sunday morning talk shows, saying that, well, those people are going to Wall Street, they're going to get arrested. And so it was like he was making a distinction that you can walk down Fifth Avenue, you can protest in Queens, but be clear, you're going to be arrested if you go to Wall Street, which means that Wall Street has some special significance to the powers that be.
Well, we can see that at BAI. You come here to BAI,
right.
In the street, you can't go down the street, yep, in a car.
Right,
there's
right.
These big metal barricades. There's dogs.
I just noticed it. I said, I haven't been here in a while because they filled in. There used to be
and that big, huge American flag. That big, huge American flag. It is the American flag.
There's a huge American flag on the stock exchange, right, because American flag and the stock exchange
so that's
have a lot in common.
That's why we're going there. We're asking people.
Give people the particulars of where to meet and
12 o'clock, Thursday, December 21st. Going to meet at Chase Plaza, which is on Liberty and Nassau Streets, and that's Nassau Street is one block east of Broadway, and Liberty is about three blocks north of Wall Street. So if you get down to the Wall Street area, just ask anybody where Chase Plaza is or where Liberty and Nassau is. 12 o'clock, be there, and you know, take the time off. It's important for us to make a statement, and also to let people like Koch know that the First Amendment still extends to Wall Street, and that we have a right to protest there, and that they're not exempt. They're just as accountable as the police department has got to be.
This program airs nationally all across the country, and wherever you're listening to this program, whether you're listening to it on the radio or on the internet, I know that you are somewhere that has a police problem, because no place is immune to this. And so there are a couple things that we can do. Roger spoke about it earlier, some international mechanisms, in mm-hmm. addition to the local that we encourage everybody to take. But I met last week with Dudu Jin. He's the UN Special Rapporteur on Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Related Intolerance. Now, his job is to investigate around the world incidents of racism. I went into that room where civil society groups were meeting with him, and I was really shocked to see the lack of community members, true community members there. What we talked about for the majority of the time was anti-Semitism. And while that's a problem, that is not the major problem of racism in this country. What we need to do, and he has said, is, look, I need to hear from people. I need to know what their problems are. So if you write in to lawanddisorder.org, we'll make sure that your stories get straight to this UN Special Rapporteur on Racism. Tell us what's happened. He said, I can take individual cases straight to the UN. It doesn't just have to be a trend. I can take an individual case. So if your case is one of racism or of religious intolerance, no matter what religion, tell us. Write in about it, and we'll make sure that case gets to him.
That's true. You know, we met with him about a month ago, and what's happened is that the UN, before it became the Human Rights Council, it was the Commission on Human Rights, used to meet once a year. Now they've, you know, in their new configuration, they're meeting like three different times a year. And so we normally would have attended that in terms of our, you know, our organization, the December 12th Movement, and another one, the International Association Against Torture, that I'm the International Secretary General of. But we're just strung out now. But we need the information. People should get it to you, because that becomes very, very, very important. And it does have an effect.
Yeah, and the second thing is that the U.S. has signed and ratified the international treaty, the Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, also known by its acronym CERD. Now, with CERD, what the United States is required to do is to submit a report saying, look, this is the status of racial discrimination and race relations in the United States. This is how we treat our people of color. And as you can imagine, the U.S. presents a pretty rosy picture when it comes to self-reporting. What we do out in civil society groups is we present shadow reports to the UN saying, hey, they're saying one thing, but we're saying another thing. If you go to lawanddisorder.org, I'm working with a bunch of different civil society groups through Amnesty International, and we're presenting shadow reports. And we want to know your stories. Tell us your instances of racial discrimination and how you think the U.S. government is doing, and we'll put that in there. So go to our website, lawanddisorder.org, and write us.
So, Roger, as we close, we just want to remind our listeners what the next event is, and if there's one after that, you
sure.
should just tell us.
Thursday, December 21st, 12 o'clock, Chase Plaza, Liberty, and Nassau Streets. The objective is to shut Wall Street down, to make a clear statement to those who give the orders to the mayor and the police commissioner that allowed the killing of Sean Bell, that it's got to stop, and that their business is not going to be conducted as usual as long as we face death in our communities.
Roger, give us a website.
You can email us at D12D12M, D, the number 12M, at AOL.com, or you can call 718-398-1766. That's 718-398-1766. One website, sistasplace.org, SISTASPLACE.org.
Roger Wareham, New York City civil rights attorney.
Human rights.
Thank you very much for being
on
Law and Disorder.
Invitation.
Thank you, Roger.
Thank you.
Roger was talking about really the culture of racism and the culture of murder of police departments, not only in New York, but around the country. And, you know, we really had a vivid example of that. He mentioned the Diallo killing, and of course everybody remembers Diallo, 41 bullets killing an innocent man. And he was killed as a result of an action by a group called the Special Crime Unit that was set up by the police department a number of years ago. And the purpose of that unit was to go into certain neighborhoods, particularly black neighborhoods and Latino neighborhoods, and really shake down people and look at people they considered suspicious and go after them. After Diallo was killed, the center brought a lawsuit against the New York City Police Department to try and abolish the Special Crimes Unit. And we were successful. And after we abolished the Special Crimes Unit, you couldn't just go into a black community or Latino community and shake down people after midnight without any suspicion or without any basis for doing so. So we thought maybe we're going to get a little bit of protection for the black and Latino communities in this city. And he was apparently killed by a unit that was set up almost a substitute for the Special Crime Unit called the Club Enforcement Unit that went into clubs at night and essentially did what the Special Crimes Unit used to do, except they're drinking as well. We got rid of one of the causes. They set up another one, indicating really that, as Roger has said, this issue is really endemic. It's part of, unfortunately, who this country and who our police departments are.
And so I guess the next step is making sure that police don't do what they did with the Special Crimes Unit, disband it in name only. We need to go to the root of these problems and really change the actual practices, not just the names.
New York attorney, playwright, author, and entertainer Vincent Big Jim Longhi died 2 weeks ago, and I wanted to just note his passing for our listeners. He was 90 years old when he passed. I had worked for him briefly 20 years ago. He was one of the pioneering attorneys suing insurance companies on behalf of injured people, workers, women, and children mostly. He was also a folk singer. He was friends with and shipped out with Woody Guthrie and Cisco Houston during World War II. They joined the Merchant Marine, and they were running guns and supplies across the frigid North Atlantic from New York to Murmansk in northern Russia. He had dropped out of Columbia Law School to do that. You can imagine what his Italian immigrant parents thought when he took off. When he returned, he got a job on the docks in Brooklyn. He made friends with Arthur Miller. It was Jim's recollections that helped Arthur Miller write the famous play View from the Bridge. Jim came up along with the famous New York trial lawyer, Jacob Fuchsberg. Fuchsberg went on to sit on the Court of Appeals, probably the most liberal judge to ever sit there. And he did so well for his clients and amassed such a fortune that he founded Touro Law School. And Jim worked with Fuchsberg. Fuchsberg started out as a young kid making speeches for socialism on the corners on the Lower East Side. Jim himself was around the Communist Party. Fuchsberg, Longhi, that generation identified with the underdog, and that was the kind of litigation they practiced. One quick story before we end. Jim tells the story in his book, Woody, Cisco, and Me. When they were shipping out across the North Atlantic, they were in the water three times. You can last about a minute and a half before you die of hypothermia. And they were being bombarded. They were on the ship. During those days, the Merchant Marine was totally segregated, and the black sailors were kept in one end of the ship, and the white sailors were kept in another end of the ship. They were being bombarded. They had a load of dynamite. If a bomb would have hit the ship, they would have all gone to hell. And they knew it, and everybody was terrified. Woody Guthrie started singing a song,
and Jim and Cisco joined in. And all the white sailors started singing, and they kind of overcame their fear by all singing. And then Woody said, "I'm going down to the black sailors." And they said, "You can't do that. It's a segregated ship. We'll get punished for it." And Woody said, "I'm going." And Jim said, "I'm going." And Cisco said, "I'm going." And they went down, and the white guy sang to the black merchant mariners, and the captain couldn't do a thing about it. That's how they fought the war.
Law and Disorder was produced by Jeff Brady. We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
It's all right, I think it's for your mama, one beat for the drama, hey, it's a karma, I say, when things go your way, you say, it's all right, it's all right. It's all right. Hey! It's all right. I know it's all right.